everyone. Welcome to another episode of Off the Pulpit. Really excited to have another guest. We have Pastor John Onwuchekwa. Did I say that right, John?
What's up? Perfect, man.
All right, great. He is the lead pastor of Cornerstone. It's just in the historic West End in Atlanta. He's also an author of several books, most recently We Go On, which I want to discuss a little bit in the beginning. Yeah. And also the owner and co-founder of Portrait Coffee, correct?
Co-owner. So here we go. Team. That's a team that makes it work. So
yeah, one of the most interesting pastors in the game. But hey, John, thanks so much for coming
in the
on.
Game. Thanks, man. I put 15 years in the game so far. So
I gotta ask you a question because I looked up like your biography. You grew up in Houston. You're in DC for a little bit for the Nine Marks or the Capitol Hill internship. Yeah. And now you're in Atlanta. Like, what do you consider home? Like, are you a Rockets fan? Are you a Hawks fan? Are you?
No, I'm a Rockets fan through and through. I'm taking a bit of a sabbatical from, Rockets fandom. So my heart just can't take it. Yeah, so I've been on a 2-year sabbatical. So I may pick back up next year. Yeah, I still keep track. I watch the condensed version of all of the games the day after. So they're still my team.
Gotcha.
But right now, for my sanity, man, I just had to take a bit of a sabbatical. Yeah.
So you were young during the Hakeem days.
That was when I came to love basketball. You know, fourth grade and fifth grade. We won those back to backs. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. Basketball is going to be what I do. Yeah. And
you almost made the Baylor team, right? I was reading your book.
I was a practice player. And so for anybody that's out there that knows, practice player is college basketball purgatory where it's like you're in, but you're not in. So you're in every practice. Yo, I still got, practice jerseys at the crib and nice. Run every sprint. You work for a chance to kind of get in. And then, 2 years later and, being at Baylor, I have $40,000 in student loans and it's like, hey guys, it's been real, but I'm going to have to pay this money back someday. So I can't just hang out. I've got to graduate.
It sounds like seminary a little bit.
Right.
And then you became a pastor.
Right? And then I became a pastor.
And then you're probably the only pastor I know who also is co-owner of a coffee shop. Briefly, what kind of led you there?
Oh, yeah. So what led me there was just being a fan of coffee. So I was a fan of coffee for the past 10 years. Well, I hated coffee for my whole life. I kind of have these rules that I create for myself. Very arbitrary, but they are rules nonetheless that I live by. And one of the rules that I had for my life was I don't drink warm drinks. They aren't particularly appetizing, or they weren't. And so I got into coffee 11 years, broke a rule. And then I've got this thing with me. It's got to be a disorder of some sorts where most people, when they're interested in something, they've got a dimmer switch where they can slowly say, I want to learn more about this. I don't have that. I've got a light switch. It's pitch black or the floodlights come on. So I dove headfirst into coffee and I bought everything, learned all the ways to make it. And for the past 12 years now, I've gotten a chance to, travel and speak some. And what really got me into coffee is, there's something that has to be done is everywhere I would go to, from Montreal to Memphis to St. Louis to Philly to Chicago to the Bay, you walk into a coffee shop and it looks exactly the same, right? It's all white people, the bearded white dudes with the flannels, little cleavage showing, the jeans too tight and wielding an axe and there's not a tree in sight. I'm like, why do y'all have axes? And I realized I don't fit in here. So I thought, maybe coffee's just like a white people thing. Maybe I'm going to be the Tiger Woods of this thing. And and then I started to read in books and I found out, wait a minute. Coffee actually grows, or it came from Ethiopia. Coffee grows where black and brown folks grow. But you think about And then we got to the point where it's like, yo, it's this $250 billion industry per year. And by the time that train makes its way to the top of the train station, there's not many people that look like us. And so for me, it just turned into, there's something wrong with that. I want to change the picture that comes to mind when people think of coffee. I live in a city that has been divided by, redlining and things like that, where the majority of the black people live on the south side of the city. Most of the white people live on the north side of the city. Most of the poverty is on the south side of the city. Most of the wealth is on the north side of the city. And I saw that the coffee supply chain mirrors what the train does in our own city. And so as we lived here in the West End, we sat and talked with folks, and I think the hobby turned into more of a burden. And we said, yo, in the opportunity desert that is the West End, is there an industry that we could bring in here, set up our HQ, and could help to change the economic trajectory in the community that we live in? So I live in the West End, pastor church in the West End, and the shop is right there in the West End. And long story short, signed a 5-year lease on a building for a coffee shop March 1st of 2020.
Oh, wow.
I know. And then the pandemic shut things down. But in hindsight, it was good news because it forced us to pivot e-commerce. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, it's all right. We're on Target.com. We're closing another big box retailer here in the summer. And things have just been crazy. So that's the That's the long story long about how I got into coffee.
Funny story. A friend of mine went up to Alaska to visit recently and saw like a group of guys, white guys, bearded, flannel, axes. And my friend legit was like, oh, they have artisan coffee shops in Alaska. And they found out, though, they were like, what are you talking about? They were actual lumberjacks.
they're the real ones.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, they're the real ones.
That's hilarious.
You talked a lot about that in your book, and I'm gonna chat for that a little bit before we get into other questions that we go on. Thank you for writing it. I found Ecclesiastes a really helpful book for my own ministry in the Bay Area. Right. I think it's underused, especially for millennials and Gen Z. Like, I think there's so much power to it. Thank you for writing and producing an aesthetically pleasing Christian book. I haven't seen that in a while.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that was the that's the goal. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you don't know, he has a black and white, all black and white, right? Photography kind of interlaced in between. It was a really nice break. It was a nice, not to like hype it up a little bit more, but it was nice hearing examples again that weren't white context. It was like The Wire. I watched that show.
There
a lot
we
of
go.
Hip-hop. So really quick, just with that book, like one question I had for you was kind of after I read it, reflecting on We Go On, what do you feel like for your congregation, the most common ways people try and find purpose in this current age that you're, you're in Atlanta, did that help you write that book, that question, that angst?
The primary way that people try to find it, I feel like, is stuff and status, right? Is blue check marks and stuff that'll help folks, right, get towards that place where people know who they are and are substantial. I just find so many people chasing career goals, building generational wealth, like all of these things that aren't bad in and of themselves, but they become these overwhelming preoccupations. And that to me was really, I mean, why I think the book of Ecclesiastes is so dope. And it was for me, like, we're coming up on 7 years from the day that my brother died. And after he died, I just kind of, he's like he was the closest sibling that I had, right? I had four, and I found myself in a depression, felt like I just lost everything. And I had this deep sense of, meaningless, everything's meaningless. And it was like picking up that book a year after he passed and reading the words of the Solomon figure, right? Who starts off the book and says, meaningless, all is meaningless. And that's what caught me, because I came to the conclusion life was meaningless because of all the stuff that I felt that I lost. he came to that same conclusion because all the stuff that he had. And so I felt like, oh, maybe stuff or status isn't the problem. Maybe there's something else. Maybe there's some other source of meaning where people that have it all and lose it all feel as if they feel as if they've been on the wrong road. And in some sense they have, but yeah, purpose isn't found in stuff or status.
I feel like for the three of us, we primarily pastor in a context where the majority of our people are like middle class.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, the way they find purpose could be shaped in a different way based on that socioeconomic context. For you, you know, you probably encounter not just middle class, but lower class, upper class. Like, do you sense that that shapes how they struggle with purpose?
Absolutely. So I do think it's like, so, you know, one of the things we talked through a whole lot is like, people that are middle class or upper class, they tend to, or some folks tend to look for purpose in their work or in their job, right? And that's why one of the things you find is a lot of the faith and work stuff that's produced in Christian spaces is usually for middle or upper class folks, right? People that are that work for ends meet are not tempted to find their identity and their source of well-being in being an employee of the month at Wendy's, right? That's just not a temptation. So it's, so for some folks, it is like work and career. And then for other folks, it's relationships and things like that. And one of the things that is weird, and I do feel like it's a recent phenomenon, or maybe people feel like they can hold it on more, is, you know, 15 years ago, if you were lower class, you would not spend your time trying to find meaning or purpose in status, because there wasn't really legitimate, quick, simple, easy A to B straight lines for you to get status. But now with the rise of social media and TikTok influencers and all of this stuff, you find more and more, right, people that find themselves in depressing circumstances, placing their hope for freedom or joy or purpose in being known, because everybody's got a phone and Wi-Fi, and there is kind of more of a hunger and a longing for status in certain communities that otherwise would have tried to find it in something else.
I have a question. You know, I love the book as well. I thought it was one of the most pastoral treatments of Ecclesiastes that I've read. And so thank you for that. Something that I thought of, you know, one of the things you talk a lot about is community. You know, even in the last words, I mean, I loved it. I love how you ended the book. You know, where do we go from here? We go on together, and with purpose. We all pastor in California, on the coasts, where individualism is huge. And so people are having these existential crises for the most part, like alone. And how do you, in a individualistic world or culture, how does the church cultivate community? That, you know, how do you create those spaces for people who are, all they're getting is individualism?
So I do think one of the things is like bringing an awareness to it and just trying to help people see, like, that's what goes on, right? There's an old proverb that says, if you want to know what water is, don't ask a fish, because they just swim in it and they can't really tell you. In Galatians 1, Paul is like, oh, Christ died to save us, to rescue us from this present evil age. And so there's times where we just stop and call our church and remind them, no. The evilness of the age isn't just that it's like nefarious. It's that it's sinister and it's subtle and you don't even know that it's there, right? That it's like that the streams of our world are going to tell you to like use your discretionary income, not to be generous and help somebody in need, not to build relationships, not to give to those who are without, right? Not to cultivate friendships. They're going to tell you to use all your discretionary income for Invisalign, to fix your smile so you can impress people, to use it for right clothes, you can impress people, to use it for a nice car. And people are basically working, not doing anything that's morally wrong, but they are laying these like bricks of the perks of their job and Christian freedom that at the end of the day are building prison walls around their soul and they don't know. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing that we try to do is just call attention to the fact like, no, listen, community is not just a suggestion, right? When you talk about hindrances to relationship with God and health, the focus on the importance of community as a hindrance to relationship with God actually precedes the imperfection, right? Genesis 2 comes before Genesis 3. So before sin was in the world, God's going to look down and say, yo, listen, I know I've just gotten through saying it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. But look, this is not good, the man being all by himself. So really just trying to help our folks understand that it's like, yo, isolation is a bigger problem than you just trying to stave off the tides of imperfection that come. And so I found it's creating an awareness. And before anything, you know, practical takes place, I spend my time constantly trying to tell stories of the benefits and the cons, right? That I feel like it's really narrative reshaping that moves people's actions, right? Narrative engages people's emotions, and emotions are people's motors. So everybody knows that they should be in a small group or that they should be with folks, but it's like, why don't they have the motor to do it? And it's because they're convinced that it's true and it's right, but it's not like real. So that was why, well, in part in the book, it's like, yo, coffee has been great and all this stuff. And folks look and say, ah, that's great. And it's like, I'm sometimes to a fault, right? Where people think, man, John just got lucky because he don't do nothing, right? To a fault, I'm like, no, listen. But the only reason that I did that was because of a team and people and like, no, our church, it's a, no, listen, I don't do it all. Like, I've just changed my entire, role because of how much I value our team and I know my place in it. No, marriage, no, friendships, no, grief, no, all of that. So in every part of my life, I'm trying to like pull on that thread of community so that if anybody hears me tell any story, even if we're talking one-on-one, they always hear me use first person plural pronouns. And I'm constantly saying, nah, we, us, we, yeah.
No, that's really helpful to hear. And speaking on that, I guess kind of pivoting but related, and I guess turning up the heat a little bit, on community for the broader church, we're in a very interesting moment, at least for the American evangelical church, especially in our quasi, you know, reform circle movement thing that's been going on. Right. You're an interesting place that I found. You're still on the board at the Gospel Coalition from...
I resigned.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, perfect. Okay. Let me chat about that. All right. Let me give you some background on why we even started this podcast.
Okay. Yeah.
We're all three of us are Korean American. And for the Asian American church, I think for a long time, we kind of looked into this white evangelical reform movement happening, right? We're a very, very recent church. Like, we're a first generation Asian American church, like as a whole. And we kind of like, oh, you know, they're about the gospel. So let's kind of slide in. And we slid into TGC and all these circles. And the past 2 years, we're like, wait a second, like this isn't exactly what we thought or what we signed up for. And
right.
we're in the midst of trying to figure out how much white evangelicalism has influenced us and in good and bad ways, but we don't know what it even means to be Asian American. And as I look to the African American church, like this has been the story for, you know, hundreds of years. And I guess for this moment right now, what are your thoughts? Like, this is a very general question and we can go from here. Like, what are your thoughts on the future for ethnic ministries coming out of a white dominant evangelical world?
Yeah. So I think there's the healthiest ones are going to be the people that are asking the questions that you just said, right? Yo, we're starting to come out and we don't even know how much that we've been shaped. So we're going to chill and we're going to answer that question before we immediately start hurling both, you know, arrows and insults back at that way, right? Because it's like until you know how much you've been shaped, it's the type of thing where you can't, like, you can't be, you can be accurate in some of your critique, but I don't think you can be completely balanced and fair in that you feel all the ways in which you've been constrained for the worse, but you don't really understand the many ways that you've been shaped for the better, right? It's the difference between, you know, the 19-year-old that goes home for Christmas break and the 33-year-old that goes home for Christmas break, right? The 19-year-old, I remember being 19, yo, and I went home and sitting with my folks and, you know, all the stuff I learned in three semesters at college. And I was just ready to teach and instruct my mom and my dad. Then I remember 33 years old saying, yo, hey, there's places in which we disagree, but my conversation was more, you know, nuanced and sobered and full of understanding and all the things that go into play, right? And it's also realizing that, like, all white evangelical organizations and institutions aren't created equal. They're not all the same. There are some that are, harmful and destructive, and there's a mixture of both ignorance and arrogance that exists in it, which is a dangerous combination that when you leave, or when I've left, there's been some that it's like, oh, no, I've left and I think something needs to be said, because no, this ain't just let's agree to disagree. This is something worse than that, right? And my conscience would be constrained if I didn't write a public facing thing. With TGC, I didn't have that experience nor that involvement. And so it's like there was no public facing letter. There was no big deal. It was no, hey, all the black people should get out. It was just saying, hey, listen, I've got a limited amount of extracurricular time, and I just want to invest that in a place where, where the volume knobs are turned in the direction that I want them to be in, right? So TGC talks about justice and race stuff, right? It's a, I wish they would turn that volume knob up more. TGC talks about complementarian and egalitarian stuff. I wish they would turn that knob down more, at least to the point that they turn out, you know, the Baptist and Presbyterian conversation, right? There's a place for people who have divergent hermeneutics on an important matter like that to cooperate. And so what, and so for me, it was like just, no, man, I'm grateful for the work that's been there. I'm grateful for the relationships that I've formed there. But I think of my ministry context and where I am here, it's I don't want to be the voice in the room that is saying, hey, can we turn that up? And but can we turn that down? But can we turn this up and turn that down? It's a big ship that's already moving and starting to do good things. And so I'd rather just like, take the little tugboat off the side of the ship and say, I want to be a little more nimble to do things. So, but at the end of the day, man, grateful for the brothers there and some of the organizational stuff that I don't feel the same way for other white evangelical institutions.
I guess to press in a little deeper on that, I feel like people are at different places when it comes to the situation you're describing. Like you have some people who they want to strive for cooperation, and through cooperation they can bring change from the inside and so forth. And then you have some folks who they just experienced, they tried that, and now they're almost in a place of resignation and they're done or they're even angry. You know, we saw different people like that. Like Tabidi is a classic example where he was just in that place where he was with, you know, masters, and he was at Capitol Hill and he's at TGC, but he just kind of left all that. And you kind of get a sense that, oh, he felt, experienced a lot of disillusionment from it. And so you're unique because we saw you like, oh, you're actually there. You know, you wrote, but I got introduced to you through the Nine Mark stuff, and you're like, at, you know, TGC and so forth. So it seemed like you were kind of there. And as you experienced that and try to, I guess, cooperate in those institutions, do you have hope that, oh, maybe not for you to be that person, but do you have hope? Like, no, there could be change that takes place. Or are you kind of more like, you know, maybe not in our generation. You almost have to do your own thing to make things work.
This is what I'll say. Whenever anybody asks me if I have hope, my religious framework is based off a religion with somebody where a guy got up from the dead, right? So there's always hope, right? So from that standpoint, it's like I'm never hopeless. So that's ontologically, right? Hope exists and it's there. Do I personally think that some of the largest white evangelical institutions will change? No. But it's like, no, but I'm not trying, but I've been wrong, right? I've been wrong about a bunch of things. Quick story, because I like stories. When I was a college pastor, this guy who shall remain nameless came up to me and was like, yo, there's this girl here. Yo, I want to talk to her. I think that she's the one for me. And in my head, I'm like, nah, man, you're like, she's way out of your league. This is going to be bad. So I start to give him speeches about contentment. Like, oh, one time, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they trusted God, but they said, even if God doesn't, that he's not going to serve. So I'm trying to get him there. And I'm like, no way this works. No way this works at all. And they're married. And they've got lots of kids. And that was the first time it hit me, like, oh, no, no, no. I can have strong judgments about something that I think are very, very clear and be terribly, terribly wrong. So from that standpoint, I was wrong, right? So I don't think so. I do think that there was a time and a season that those organizations were like at the top, and they helped, and there was a thriving, and there was a unique role for the unique season that we're in. I feel like that season is ending, and I feel like, yeah, like it's the life cycle of everything. Nobody stays at the top or at a top position of influence forever. No person, no organization. And so I'm not like praying for their demise or their downfall, right? So that's not me. But I am preparing, I do think, for like what's next. And I do think what's next is, and we just wrote about this up on a blog that we have with Crete. It's like, yo, solidarity is our currency of choice, right? Everybody, whenever you start to talk about issues of race, when you find yourself in a predominantly white space, or at least as has been my experience, you start to talk about racial dynamics and it immediately becomes a conversation about diversity, racial reconciliation. And that is just, diversity is valuable, but it's not the currency that's needed to solve the problems that people are starting to talk through. I went to India in 2018. I came back home and had a pocket full of rupees, and a guy in the West End asked me to buy him a sandwich. I could have sat down and said, no, listen, these rupees, listen, they're valuable. They're hundreds of dollars. But he's like, yo, it may be inherently valuable, but it is practically useless to what I'm trying to do here. Your rupees aren't going to get me any close to a sandwich. And I think in contexts like ours, or like we know this, right? We are the diversity. We've been the diversity in the schools we go to, the banks we frequent, the government buildings, right? So people that are having issues with injustice are not calling out for payment in the currency of diversity. It's not, man, I just really wish that a diverse group of people would come spilling out of the church, right? What we found is, if a diverse group of people comes spilling out of the church and they step over the hungry and the houseless, the hungry and the houseless do not care about the diversity. Wow. If a church that is not diverse spills out of the church and nobody steps over, but they feed and they clothe and they help the hungry and the houseless man and they show him solidarity, he's going to say, yo, tell me who this God is that cares about the poor, not, I would believe in your God, but the ratio here is just off. I wish things were a little more diverse, right? And so I think we have people, in our world that are calling out for solidarity amongst issues of racial injustice. And the most diverse places that you see are people who aren't talking about diversity, but people that are talking about solidarity, right? Wow. So our main thing is this, whenever I find myself in a room or a convo and anybody says, yeah, and we talk about what we're trying to do with Crete and church planning and the work here, and they say, yeah, man, I'm passionate about diversity. I say, I just need you to control F on that word, find every mention of it. And everywhere you think to use the word diversity, replace it with solidarity. And if you do that, I think that you'll get a sense of what it is that we're trying to do and how it's different from what it is that you thought that we were trying to do. And so organizations that have that at the center, it seems like, are going to be prepared to legitimately meet the needs of where our world is trying to go. Organizations that are still talking about diversity, I think are going to, depending on the amount of resources that they have, either quickly or slowly fade into obscurity, but it's going to be a fade nonetheless. And I say all that with a disclaimer of, I've been wrong before. My homie's married to a girl I thought was out of his league. I believe in a guy that got up from the dead. So I could be wrong. And if I'm wrong, I would love to be memeified and people clown me on being wrong on this one, because it would be like, yo, great. I would have no greater joy than to be wrong. Saying I told you so in the end doesn't give me any sense of pleasure, but I could be wrong.
No, that's so good. I guess on that same line, like, you know, we saw huge shifts in the denominational landscape in the last couple of years, huge names like leaving denominations pretty openly. Like, what do you think the future, you know, because like all three of us pastor non-denominational churches, that question has come up a lot, because I think historically we thought that the road to legitimacy had to go through, like, we had to attach ourselves to these huge kind of like white evangelical denominations. Do you feel like the future is like more networks, or do you feel like more minority led? Like, where do you think the church is going on that on that front?
Yeah. This is what I will say. And I think sometimes we have a tendency to equate our experience with a particular institution. So say, or a particular type of institution. So say denominations, right? And we would say, yeah, you know, denominationalism is X, Y, and Z. And it's but I've only been a part of predominantly white denominations, right? So I know in the past, people have spoken very matter-of-factly about what the future of denominationalism is. And I've heard other people who have been a part of different denominations with different cultural leanings say things like, wait a minute, you're speaking as if white evangelical denominations are the only denominations that there are, right? So that's where it's like, I kind of have pause for that, right? Mm. For the landscape that we're in, I don't think that predominantly white evangelical institutions are particularly equipped, set up, or geared as they are constructed right now to kind of hold a court of relevance to the changing landscape. I feel like it just feels like, you know, incredibly disconnected. Like, I grew up skating all the time. I would love to roller skate. And you would have these like skates where the outside wheel on one skate would just kind of slowly drift. And it's fine in the short term, but eventually if you push them across the rink, like one could go straight and the other one would just kind of wouldn't make it to whatever line you were trying to push. It would just kind of loop around, right? I feel like there's enough of a misalignment with a lot of these denominations as constructed, from who holds the power, what concerns are seen as legitimate, who is seen as a prophet and a troublemaker. There's just enough of a misalignment where, yeah, I think it's just going to drift or slowly fade into obscurity. And there is an aspect where I do think right now we are experiencing a little bit of redrawing of the line, refixing the like borders and the boundaries, right? So you look at like early maps of the United States and you're like, oh yeah, that place is Texas shaped. It's not the Texas that we know right now, right? There's constantly this like redrawing of the borders of who's in and who's out. And I think we're starting to see that now, right? We're starting to see, wait. Who said that who said complementarianism and egalitarian has to be a border for meaningful partnership, right? Right. I'm not saying that it should or shouldn't, but it's like, no. Who said, like, there have been lines that have been drawn that says, no, it's okay to have a different hermeneutic on the Bible when it comes to baptism, when it comes to who should preach or pastor, if you have a hermeneutical difference, where both sides can still love the authority of the Bible somehow in certain places, right? Those borders are out of bounds. And what we're saying is, I think there's a group of folks that are starting to come up that are saying, oh, no, wait. I don't think that border that you put up is a foregone conclusion. I think there's a argument that can be made. And there are organizations right now that do that. So more so than if the denominations are going to be there or not, I think there is there's a redrawing of the lines of partnership.
Mm-hmm. I think it was John Piper who said it, no?
I don't know. You know, people got a lot of beef with John Piper right now. I don't.
Yeah, we're cool with John Piper too. Right. We're cool. But...
Yeah. I don't necessarily.
You can take the part out, Eugene. Right.
I know we're coming off with the time allotted with you. I guess just really quickly to end, we have a lot of leaders, especially Asian American leaders, pastors who might listen to this and they're in a confusing spot. Like, the lines are being redrawn. They thought they were safe here, but they're realizing, wait, either I'm not safe here, or that's not what I thought was a border, right? So I guess if you're really practical, to give, you know, leaders, church planters, pastors of, you know, just that are Asian American, they find themselves kind of like, oh, where am I? What practical or hopeful advice would you just give them really quickly to end?
Yeah. Feel free to be honest and to be yourself, right? There's an aspect of, and again, I'm speaking about my experience. I feel like you have to throw that as a disclaimer. So, you know, I'm grateful to God for the education, the institutions that I've been to, right? Even in like academic and theological institutions and training, sometimes in some of these spaces, you don't realize just how much you are shaped by the disclaimers that you get, right? And so it's like, I read this, but you got to be careful because he doesn't, blah, 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 or we don't agree with all of that. And it's like, no, 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 I get it. Like, we're in an academic setting, so we can talk about that on the back end and work through and be persuasive. Don't just block it off. And so I saw a whole lot of that. And so it's funny because it's actually been in the, you know, once you find the freedom to not to feel like you have to conform, it's even rereading the books on your bookshelves without the disclaimers makes me feel like, oh, yeah, they gave me this Four Views book and they were really told me to be careful about all the rest of these views. But I actually think I agree with this view after being in it more. And there's just a freedom to be able to do that where, yeah, there's been other academic settings that I've been in. And, right, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, there's some places where I've been in and I've just sat and it's like, yo, y'all are wilding. The Bible is true. You can't just throw out the Bible. But in some places they've been there and it's like, they'll put a resource in my hand from somebody that it's like, yo, y'all are bugging. And then they'll put a resource in my hand from somebody that's conservative and evangelical. And the way that they talk about both books is they talk about what they'd enjoyed of both. And there's a foregone conclusion. Nah, of course, I don't agree with all of this that's in here, but the resources haven't been given with as much of a disclaimer, even the ones that we would sign off on. And so from that, it would be, yo, stay in community, right? I love what y'all have right here. The fact that, man, y'all are three different churches, pastors, you know, all on the West Coast, y'all don't just like y'all aren't just wading through the issues, but y'all have this like shared contextual bond that forces y'all to be honest and relevant in what y'all work through. And so I'd say, yo, find people that you trust, find people that you can be honest with, stay close, and you know, reread some of the books on your bookshelves in light of a changing context.
I like that one. John, thanks so much, man.
You can
reread We Go On if you're listening, because that's
the one
you can totally read. So
you can reread it and re-gift it. I got to make this advance back. So
yes, sir.
No, I'm just playing. Man, this is an honor. I'd love to do it again. So whenever y'all want to have me on, all right, back on. All right. Sorry, I don't want to invite myself back on.
If there's ever a
part two, man, I would love to.
Always an open invite.
We had Mark Sayers on twice, and we said he's now our friend because he's on twice. So when you come on twice, you're our friend.
Oh, come on.
But yeah, cool. Well, hey, John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.